What if I told you that America once had some of the world's most magnificent public swimming pools, grand resort-style facilities where entire communities gathered, and then deliberately destroyed them? In the 1950s, rather than allow Black children to swim alongside white children, towns across America chose to drain their pools, fill them with concrete, or let them decay into weeds. This wasn't just about swimming. It was about a choice that continues to define American life. Would we rather have nothing than share something with people who don't look like us? This question sits at the heart of why the wealthiest nation on earth can't seem to provide its citizens with affordable healthcare, debt-free college, or functioning infrastructure. The drained pool isn't just history. It's a metaphor for how racism has drained America's capacity to invest in collective prosperity, leaving everyone worse off. A Harvard study found white Americans increasingly view racism as a seesaw. When people of color rise, white people must fall. They rated anti-white bias as worse than anti-Black bias, while Black Americans saw no such competition. This zero-sum thinking isn't human nature. It's deliberately constructed. European colonizers invented racial hierarchies to justify stealing land and enslaving people. Colonial America built an economic system where enslaved people were both workers and tradable assets, with early colonists defining their freedom against the absolute unfreedom of enslaved Africans. After cross-racial uprisings threatened power structures, Virginia's 1705 laws separated servants by skin color, granting property rights to white servants while confiscating property from enslaved people. Even the poorest white person gained a psychic wage, elevation in the racial hierarchy based solely on skin color. The Constitution contained 10 pro-slavery passages, and the first Congress confined citizenship to free white persons. Each generation since has revived these fears, with elites spreading anxieties about job competition while redistributing wealth upward and directing white resentment toward lateral scapegoats. America has the world's largest economy, yet ranks near the bottom among wealthy nations in government spending per person. Our infrastructure earns a D-plus from engineers. The pattern traces back to slavery. In 1857, Pennsylvania had 393 public libraries, while South Carolina had 26. New Hampshire operated 2,381 public schools, while Mississippi managed only 782. 9 of the 10 poorest states remain in the South today. For most of the 20th century, America's social contract had an asterisk. Public investments were whites only. The Homestead Act, New Deal mortgages, the GI Bill, and federal highway subsidies primarily benefited white Americans while systematically excluding Black citizens. Public pools became battlegrounds in the 1950s. After courts ordered integration, white families stopped coming. St. Louis's Fairground Park pool, once the world's largest, holding 10,000 swimmers, saw attendance plummet from 313,000 to 10,000, then closed permanently. The Supreme Court blessed this destruction in 1971, ruling Jackson could close public pools rather than integrate them. As public pools disappeared, private swim clubs surged. Shared resources became luxury amenities, and entire communities lost spaces where neighbors once gathered across class lines. For generations, white Americans attended public universities funded primarily by taxpayers. That system collapsed as student bodies diversified. By 2017, most state colleges relied mainly on tuition rather than public funding. The burden falls heaviest on Black graduates. 8 in 10 must borrow, at higher levels than any other group. Despite educational achievement, white high school dropouts have higher average household wealth than Black college graduates. But now student debt affects 63% of white public college graduates too. Federal Reserve research shows debt payments prevent first home purchases, delay marriage and children, and cut retirement savings in half by age 30. Meanwhile, a third of developed nations offer free tuition, and another third keep costs below $2,600. Support for Free College shows a stark racial divide. 53% of white Americans support it, compared to over 80% of Black and Latinx Americans, with the fiercest opposition from older, college-educated white Republicans who benefited from the previous system. California's story is telling. After pioneering free college, Proposition 13 in 1978 slashed property taxes amid racial backlash, with campaigns explicitly questioning why homeowners should pay for other people's children. As student populations diversified, state priorities shifted. By 2016, 18 states spent more on incarceration than higher education. The majority of victims are now white students. About 70% of student debt crisis activist members identify as white. Josh Frost, paying 3/4 of his salary toward loans while living with his parents at 39. Teacher Emily Scott, whose $70,000 debt barely decreases despite 600 monthly payments. In 1977, Janice and Isaiah Tomlin became the first in their families to own a home in Wilmington, North Carolina. When they refinanced years later, a Chase mortgage broker exploited their Christian faith to hide a subprime mortgage with fees totaling 12% of the loan value, despite their perfect payment history. This targeting of existing homeowners, particularly Black and Brown families, was standard practice. The 2008 crisis destroyed $19.2 trillion in household wealth and 8 million jobs. Foreclosures peaked at 1.17 million in 2010. While homeowners of color were disproportionately affected, most foreclosed homes belonged to white people. The crisis had deep roots. In 1933, the Homeowners Loan Corporation created residential security maps, marking neighborhoods with residents of color as high risk, the birth of redlining. The Federal Housing Administration subsidized home purchases for working-class whites while refusing mortgages to borrowers of color. By 2016, typical white families held $171,000 in wealth, 10 times that of Black families, $17,600. Former Wells Fargo employees testified that 80% of their sales leads were African-American customers, deliberately steered toward expensive subprime loans regardless of creditworthiness. Between 1992 and 2008, state officials took more than 9,000 legal actions to halt predatory lending, but Washington wouldn't listen. The practices that first targeted communities of color eventually spread to middle-class white borrowers, collapsing the entire financial system. In August 2017, Nissan factory workers in Canton, Mississippi, rejected unionizing despite dangerous conditions and frozen pensions. Nissan deliberately segregated workers, Black employees in demanding trim jobs, white workers in easier, better-paid positions. This division strategy has been employers' primary weapon throughout American history. The Knights of Labor recognized this in the 1880s, organizing across color lines with "an injury to one is a concern of all." This cross-racial organizing produced a solidarity dividend. By the 1950s, 1/3 of workers were unionized, winning the 40-hour work week, overtime pay, employer health insurance, and retirement benefits. American unions uniquely declined when white support dropped in the mid-1960s, precisely when the UAW visibly supported civil rights. The South remains America's least unionized, lowest-wage region, a legacy of slavery. The Fight for $15 movement took a different approach. At SeaTac Airport in 2013, diverse workers won $15 wages after organizers helped them recognize management decisions, not immigrant workers, had caused their wage deterioration. America has never achieved truly representative democracy. The framers compromised from the start, accommodating slavery through the Three-Fifths Compromise and Electoral College. Post-revolution, a zero-sum bargain emerged. The South extended voting to all white men, while the North eliminated property requirements but stripped rights from free Black citizens. White men no longer needed wealth for esteem, just white skin. After Reconstruction, relentless assaults targeted Black and Indigenous voting rights. When impoverished white and Black citizens formed fusion alliances challenging the plantation oligarchy, the ruling class countered with white supremacy campaigns. Mississippi's 1890 literacy tests and poll taxes disenfranchised both groups. Turnout in poll tax states plummeted to 18% versus 69% nationally. Many tactics persist. Pre-registration requirements blocked nearly 20% of eligible voters in 2016, and felony disenfranchisement affects 1 in 13 Black voters versus 1 in 56 non-Black voters. After Barack Obama's election, Republican legislatures imposed restrictive laws targeting Black voters with almost surgical precision. Texas allowed gun permits but not college IDs. Alabama demanded photo IDs, then closed DMV offices in Black-majority counties. We've reached the productive and moral limit of the zero-sum model. Studies showed diverse groups outperform homogeneous ones. Racially diverse teams solve problems more effectively, and diverse juries deliberate longer and make fewer errors. Our salvation lies in embracing diversity as our superpower, living in solidarity across color, origin, and class.